Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. We're going to be in Numbers chapter 5 through chapter 10, verse 10. As you know, Numbers chapter 1 through chapter 10, verse 10 is basically preparations to leave Sinai. The next major section of the book of Numbers is, of course, the wilderness wanderings. And then the third major division is from the wilderness wanderings, or Kadesh Barnea, unto the plains of Moab, where they'll have the preparations for crossing the Jordan River, Deuteronomy, the death of Moses, and then that will begin to close out the Pentateuch. We're going to pick up in Numbers chapter 5 today. I'll give you a brief outline of what we're going to do. It kind of helps us see where we're going. Chapters 1 through 4 dealt with the census, the numbering of the people, seeing about the army. 5 and 6 deal with the cleansing of the camp. It's very important. There had to be a holiness among the camp so that God could dwell with them. And then 7 is the leaders bring gifts. The 12 tribes send special gifts for the altar for its dedication. And then in chapter 8, we have the dedication of the Levites, who, of course, took the place of the firstborn. And then number 9, we have the second Passover, and also discussion about the cloud, how it led them. And then in chapter 10, verses 1 through 10, we have the two silver trumpets that prove the historicity of this account because of its connection with Egypt. So let's begin, if we could, at chapter 5, beginning at verse 1. Now here we have, and the Lord commanded Moses, saying, command the sons of Israel that they send away from the camp. Now here are the groups of people that had to be excluded. The leper, that was discussed in Leviticus 13, 45 and 46, where the leper had to leave the camp. Having a discharge, that's Leviticus 15. Everyone who is unclean because of a dead person. And that's Leviticus 21 and Numbers 6, 6 through 8, where it relates to a Nazarite that touches a dead person. It's interesting to me that the reason these people were excluded is because they were not whole, not complete. Something about the unblemished animal that was available to sacrifice was its wholeness, its normalcy. Well, I won't tell you what. When I look at these rules, and these poor people had to be driven outside the camp, they had to live out there, and boy, it was terrible for these individuals. Though I recognize it showed the holiness of God, for these particular individuals, it was miserable. Jesus dealt with every one of these kind of individuals, with a leper, with a woman with a discharge, where he touched dead people himself. Jesus shows that this has passed away as a way to know who God is. In this period, there had to be a sense of holiness because of the terrible abominations of the Canaanites and the Egyptian worship patterns. And God taught them through these forms, but these are passing away forms. Notice again it says in verse 3, both male and female. There's no distinction between who was a leper and who had a bodily emission and who touched a dead person. There it says they have to leave, go outside the camp, so they defy their camp where I dwell in their midst. Now God symbolically dwelt in the Holy of Holies, between the cherubim, above the mercy seat. Notice it says, as the sons of Israel did and sent them outside the camp, just as the Lord had spoken to Moses. Then in verse 5, speak to the sons of Israel, when a man or woman commits any sin of mankind, acting unfaithfully against the Lord, that person is guilty. Now we've talked about the ceremonial uncleanness. Now we're going to deal about the uncleanness caused by personal sin or rebellion. This is kind of a summary of two of the very particular kinds of sacrifice. It's going to be the guilt offering is going to be mentioned here. Notice it mentions here they are to confess their sins, and that's in verse 7, and they are to make restitution and add a fifth to it, and then down in verse 8, they are to offer the ram of atonement. Now, here are the three basic elements. Number one, I think this idea of confession is very important. We see it in 1 John chapter 1, verse 9, that us publicly admitting that we have sinned is a part of the act of being cleansed. It's an attitude on our part that says, oh God, I'm so sorry that I have violated who you are and what you stand for. And the second thing of restitution here, we ought to remember that if we have done something against a covenant partner, we ought to try to make it right. In the Old Testament, as we learn from Leviticus chapter 6, they were to add one-fifth to it. Then again it says, and then down in verse 8, it's this idea of the ram of atonement. There was a sacrifice. An innocent animal died. The soul that sins, it will surely die. But I have given the blood to make atonement for you. So this innocent animal took the place. Then verse 8 also mentions of a man die who has no relative. The rabbis would argue, well, what Israeli did not have relatives? So the Hebrews would say this goes back primarily to the proselyte. And if they died, what would happen to their property? Now, beginning in verse 11, the rest of this chapter is something we are surprised about. And I must admit to you, the procedure has some superstitious elements in it. It's the test for adultery. I think God realized that adultery could rip a family apart, rip a society apart, as adultery could because of the inheritance patterns meaning so much to the Jew. And this is basically given to the man who thinks his wife has been unfaithful. Now, the Jews tend to say the wife has to be some evidence that the wife is unfaithful. Not that the husband just thinks she might be, but there has to be some evidence, maybe one witness, or maybe someone saw her with this man, or something. And then here's the procedure. Notice in verse 14 it says, if a spirit of jealousy overcomes him. I've heard many people try to say, there's a demon named the spirit of jealousy. No, this is a metaphor for an attitude in this husband's heart. He thinks his wife has been unfaithful. It bothers him. He can't get any sleep. Now, notice, so here's the procedure. He's to bring his wife and an offering to the priest. The offering in verse 15 is a part of a one-tenth of an ephah of barley. Very cheap kind of thing. A very poorest kind of bread was made out of this. No frankincense, no incense, no oil added to it. Shows it's kind of it's a way of saying it's a serious thing. It's a thing involving sin. No joy, no happiness here. And notice also it's to be a grain offer memorial, a reminder of iniquity. The whole structure of this is to make the lady feel guilty. If she has committed an act of unfaithfulness, every aspect of this ritual is going to recall that to her mind. And it's almost a psychological kind of thing. If she's going to feel guilty and guilt's going to affect her physical body, although the whole thrust is that God's going to be involved in this. But it is a pretty manipulative psychological practice. I was reading the pulpit commentary that condemned this as being something they did only for a period of time, but we just don't know that. Now, here are the elements involved in verse 17. Holy water, we think that means comes from the laver, and some dust taken from the floor of the tabernacle. Many theories have said, well, man's going to return to dust, or dust the serpent crawl. We don't know why the dust. It was some kind of a symbol maybe of uncleanness, but off the tabernacle floor is going to be an element of the curse involved in this. And then we have, what is the woman supposed to do? Well, there's a series about five things. The first one's found in verse 18, stand before the Lord. B, let her hair go loose. That seemed to have the idea of being maybe open to God, more open to God, like taking off your shoes. Or some say, no, it was a sign of repentance. And they get that from the leper had to undo his hair in Leviticus 13:45. Some say, no, it was a sign of mourning. And so I'm just not sure which it is. But she had to stand before the Lord, undo her hair. In verse 19, she had to take an oath. Now, the priest part was to get the elements together, was to have her repeat the oral oath and have her to write this curse. And then in C, in 21 was the next one, and she's to swear the oath. And then, let's see, here's the curse in verse 21, your thigh will waste away and your abdomen swell. Now, so the rabbi said that shows that the punishment was to fit the crime. If she was guilty of a sexual crime, the organs of the sexual act involved would be the organs that would pay the price. If she was pregnant, she'd lose her baby. If she was guilty, she would not be able to have children anymore, which is a terrible curse in the Israelis to not be able to have children. She was to say amen, amen, in verse 22. Here we see the word amen, which is the same form as the word for faith. And this is used in the way we use it to mean I agree, I affirm, I assert this curse should be mine if I have done wrong. And then the priest writes these curses on a scroll, and he washes it in the same water. And the ink is washed off into the water. And she's going to drink this water with the ink of that curse on there. You get the kind of manipulative elements. And it's called wash them off in the water of bitterness. And then in verse 26, she's to drink this water. There was one other drink curse or problem related to sin and drinking it. And that was found in Exodus 32:20 when Moses ground up the golden calf and made them drink it. These drink kind of curses are very common in Africa. Common in Hittite culture to some extent. This is the only kind we have in the Bible. And notice verse 28, if she's not guilty, she'll be free to have children. That's the key to interpret 21, I think, about her thigh wasting and her belly swelling. Now, I want to mention to you that in verse 30 it says, the man shall be free from guilt. Now, there's two ideas here. Some say it refers to the sexual partner involved, but I don't think that's true. It's the husband that's going to be free from guilt. How? What if his wife dies? He's free from guilt. What if he brought her by accident and she really wasn't guilty? Is he supposed to feel guilty and bear the problem of his jealousy? No, he's going to be free in this. And so I think you get the idea here. Now, in chapter 6, We're going to have a special sign of commitment, both for men and women. That's very unusual and very significant. This is called a Nazirite vow. It's a special dedicatory vow. Now, we look in Leviticus 27 of the significance of vows and discussion about vows in Leviticus 27. But here's this special dedication. It says, when a man or a woman makes a special vow, the vow of a Nazirite. Now, the word Nazir, we think, means to set something apart, a separated one. And I think that's the idea here, to dedicate himself to the Lord. Now, here's three things this is going to involve. And by the way, there's two kinds of Nazirite vows. One is permanent, like Samuel and John the Baptist. One is temporary, like Paul when he came to the temple in Acts and was arrested. He shall abstain from wine, not just from wine, but any kind of strong drink made from wine. He's also to refrain from eating the grape itself or the skin or any product connected with the vine. He's to abstain from. That's in verse 3. In verse 5, he's to let no razor touch his head or any part of his hair. Number 6, he is to be totally separate and not touch a dead person, even as one of his closest relatives. Now, what we basically have here is rules that relate to a priest, but even going beyond that, okay? The priest was to have no wine, but only while on duty. The Nazirite, no wine at all. The priest were to have no mourning or touching of dead persons. And, of course, the Nazirite will, too. And the special one here is a special sacrifice for uncleanness. And that's an involved sacrifice if they accidentally touch the dead person. Now, some would say that this abstinence from wine was a way of subtly saying we reject the urban society that Israel would become. We want to long back for the rural society, the wilderness wandering periods where they couldn't plant vineyards, where they couldn't get wine. And maybe they're looking back to that. I'm just not quite sure. Let's see. You can see these set of sacrifices through here. If they happened to touch a dead body by accident, it was a very serious thing, and they had to start all over again, shave their head, start the vow over for whatever period of time they vowed it. An extensive set of sacrifices here. And even when they were through with their vow, there was an extensive set of sacrifices. This second set was almost as extensive as the ordination of the priest. And it showed that you had to be pretty wealthy to even do this. It was no substitute for a cheaper animal like a bird. It had to be these lambs. And in verse 20 it says, and afterward the Nazirite may drink wine, which shows it was just a temporary thing. Then in verse 24 and following, is this wonderful thing called the Aaronic blessing. Many covenant churches use this. Many say the threefold Lord here adds dignity. It's the way that Aaron was to bless the people. May the Lord bless you and keep you, shows his presence and guidance in your life, protection. May his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. It's the opposite of the turning away the face. It's the idea of God looking at you, taking notice of you. The Lord lift up his countenance to you, which means take special notice of you. Lift your face, see who you are, look at you, and give you peace, which is shalom in Hebrew, which means wholeness. And this is the way they invoke the name of God on the people. The name of God represented the character of God. As they live in this special covenant relationship, they'd reflect God's character and God would bless them. Now in chapter 40, it's going to talk about the special sacrifice for the leaders of Israel. Each one of them was elected. There were 12 of them. And notice that the tabernacle is finished, but they're going to specially dedicate the altar. It says, and consecrate it with all of its furnishings. You might want to see Exodus chapter 40, where it was finally finished and Aaron and was not a part, but Moses dedicated it. We're not sure exactly the time frame between the end of Exodus and the beginning of Numbers. We're just not sure how it all fits together. Notice again, then, it mentions the sacrifice of each of these 12 tribal leaders. It's mentioned in verses 7. And here's the three groups of Levites that are going to be a part of that. Now, notice it says the two carts are going to be given to part of the Levites that are going to be involved in carrying the different parts of the tabernacle. Now, if you just think with me for a minute, if you can, in your mind, picture the marching order of the camp of Israel. Judah, Ishkar, Zebulun are out front. Then you have Aaron and Moses. Then you have the priest. And then you have the Levites, these three family of Levites, camped on different sides around the tabernacle itself. Now, these three groups of Levites, two of them will be given some of these ox carts. Those who carry the curtains and the structure of the tabernacle will be given carts to help them. But the ones that carry the furniture, those holy pieces of furniture, they will not have any carts. They will have to carry them by their hand. It's also significant that the order of these tribes, Judah comes first, then Ishkar, then Zebulun, basically is the tribe of the marching order. Judah out front, and then we take the south, and then we take the west, and then we take the north. It is interesting to me that in chapter 2, verse 3 through 9, that order is given. You see it again in chapter 7. This order around the tabernacle was very similar to the way that we know of Ramses II in his military campaigns had his camp structured. Many of us believe the ox carts, the form of the camp, the marching orders of the camp, and the silver trumpets, along with the totally shaving their body as a sense of dedication, all four of these are uniquely Egyptian elements that show the historicity of this account from Exodus to Numbers. Now, here's the offering. Notice, if you would, it's going to be one silver dish in verse 13, one silver bowl, both of them full of mixed flour with oil, one gold pan full of incense, and then verse 15, one bull, one ram, one male lamb, verse 16, one male goat, verse 17, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five lambs. What an extensive sacrifice this was, and it went on for 12 days. The only purpose in this seems to be it's a way of all Israel participating in the altar. And through their representatives, they were saying, we're a part of this. And the rest of this chapter is just person after person, the same sacrifice after that, in the order of the marching order of the camp. In verse 84 through 88 is kind of a summary of all 12 sacrifices. It's interesting to me that in verse 89, Moses is going to enter the Holy of Holies and hear God talking. The Lord's going to speak to him. This idea of God dwelling above the cherubim is found in Exodus 25, 21, and 22. It's also found in Psalms 80, verse 1, and Psalms 99, verse 1. Heaven was where God lived, but his footstool was the Ark of the Covenant. And so that's why it was a very holy place, the most holy place in all Israel. Then we come to chapter 8. It's going to speak about the cleansing of the Levites. But the first thing we have here is a mention of the menorah, which is just the Hebrew word for lampstand. Now, this lampstand described in detail in Exodus 25, 31 through 40. It was solid gold, had no wood like the other pieces. It had seven little places to put the wick. And the wicks were to shine onto the table of showbread. And they were to be, of course, taken care of by the priests. We're not sure if they burnt every night or around the clock. It's somewhat uncertain. Notice it says in verse 4 of chapter 8, the pattern which the Lord showed Moses. There seems to be a heavenly tabernacle to which Moses sees and copies. You might want to see Exodus 25, 40. That implies that. And Hebrews 8, that's in the New Testament, Hebrews 8, verse 5, that specifically states that. I know it seems a little Neoplatonic to us, but it does seem to be the thrust of these two accounts, that there is a heavenly tabernacle of which the earthly tabernacle is a mere copy. Notice in verse 5 and following that the Levites are going to be dedicated. And notice it says, the sons of Israel and cleanse them. The Levites take from among the sons of Israel. You might want to see Numbers 4, 21 and following, Numbers 7, 7 through 9, to talk about these Levites. Notice it says they're to use a razor on their whole body, verse 7, this is another Egyptian element. Their dedication is much like the priest, but a little less. Instead of blood, they have oil. Instead of new clothes, they have to wash their clothes. A little less. But they are going to be the helpers of the priest. Notice in verse 10 where it says that all the Israelites laid their hands on the Levites. Now, what is that? Well, this is one of the ways we get the idea of identification as the basic symbol of laying hands on something. As they laid the hands on the sacrificial animal, it kind of took the place of the offerer. As they laid the hands on the Levite, that was a sense that the Levites took the place of the firstborn that was supposed to be uniquely dedicated to God of both man and animal. C.F. Leviticus chapter, Exodus chapter 13. Notice it mentions here, the Levite shall be mine. And again, you might want to go back to Numbers 3:12, which I think is an interesting parallel to that. Verse 16, I have taken them for myself instead of the first issue of the womb, the firstborn of all Israel. The same thing is said in verse 17, and you might want to go back to Exodus chapter 13. And the Lord gave the Levites as a gift to Aaron and to his sons. They were to be the helpers. They were kind of the heavy workers of the sanctuary. Cleaned it, took care of it, moved it. And one of the problems in the post-exilic period is they couldn't find enough Levites. They didn't want to go back and do that manual labor for the priests. They had to really go look for them. Now, down in 19, the latter part, it says, "There shall be no plague among the Israel by their coming near to the sanctuary." You might want to see chapter 1, 53. If somebody approached the sanctuary too much, violated God's holiness, many times a plague or some kind of problem, fire, broke out and could kill some of the Israelis. Here he's saying the Levites need to be close to me and there'll be no problem with them violating this very holy place because I have called them and dedicated them to that. Now, there is a problem here in the text in verse 24 when it gives the age for the Levite service between 25 years and 50 years, verse 24 and 25. But if you look back in chapter 4, it says 30 to 50 years. Now, why the discrepancy of the 5 years? Well, later on, David's going to change it to 20 years old and up because he needed more Levites in the large temple of the United Monarchy. I think the rabbis probably have the best answer possible. They say there was a 5-year apprenticeship whereby the Levites helped before they became full workers in the temple. Maybe that is the discrepancy between the 25 years here and the 30 years back in chapter 4. We know that priests begin to serve at 25, and so maybe that does fit. I also think it was interesting that God shows a time of retirement, a time when they should quit working. Down in verse 25 and 26, it says, they can still help, they just can't carry the heavy things. Maybe that's a good biblical precedent, that there is a time for us to actively work and a time for us to think about doing something else or at least reduce our level of work. I think that's interesting. Then in chapter 9, we have the idea about the second Passover. It's about 1 year since the first one. And notice it says, in the first month of the second year after they'd come out of the land of Egypt. So the time for the second Passover. Notice that the Passover is really a 8-day feast, we learn, from part of Leviticus. And it's the Passover being 1 day, and then a 7-day feast of unleavened bread being tacked onto it. So it became an 8-day feast. You might want to see Leviticus 23, 5, and 6. They're to do it just the way they did it, it says. But we wonder how that's true. They lived in houses in Egypt. Would they put the blood on the tent? We're not exactly sure of exactly how it worked in the wilderness, but I'm sure they adapted it where it would be appropriate. And then notice it says they're going to do it at twilight in verse 5 on the 14th day of the month. Now this twilight is literally between the evenings in Hebrew. Been much discussion about this. Some say it's somewhere between the hottest time of the day and the cool time of the day. That's why in the temple later on, 3 o'clock was the time of the evening sacrifice. Some say no, it's between sunset when the sun goes down and when it gets dark. Others say no, it's between when the sun starts to go down and when it actually goes down. And some quote Deuteronomy 16:6 for that. But remember, the twilight would start the new day. It's the beginning of the day for the Hebrews, not the end. Now, the real implication of chapter 9 is the people came to Moses and said, what if we could not participate? We've touched an unclean body and we just can't do it. Or in verse 10, we've been on a long trip and we're far away. So Moses, I think, is very, very smart what he does in verse 8. He says, look, I'm going to go ask God. I don't know this. I'm going to go ask God and God will tell me. Now, this shows two things. Moses just not giving his opinion about this stuff. This is a revelation of God. It may be culturally conditioned, but it's still a revelation from God himself. And so it says you can take it exactly a month later on the same day. It also adds a stipulation that if you don't take it, you'll be cut off from your people. I think it's interesting in verse 14 requires the alien to take it, which shows the Jews could pass legislation to restrict the religious activity of people in their land. And maybe we ought to hear that in America. You can legislate morality to some extent, and maybe we ought to try to implement the things of God, even though some will not understand it or wonder why we do it. Beginning in verse 10, we have these silver trumpets. Now, this is also a very uniquely Jewish element. They had silver trumpets that communicated their men in war and their worship service. From Flavius Josephus and his Antiquities of the Jews, they said this was a silver trumpet straight with a flared end about 18 inches long, which was blown in different ways to give different symbols to the camp. That's one thing it was to do, the marching orders of the camp. The first, to the gathering of the people, the marching orders of the camp, and to religious festivals. You might want to see the gathering of the congregation in verses 2 and 3, the gathering of the leaders only, verse 4, the alarm for the movement of the camp, 5 and 6, and for feast days, verse 10. Now, these golden trumpets are not the only trumpets we have in Israel. They also use the zophar, or ram horns, to communicate. It's interesting to me And in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, when the Lord comes back, it's the shout of the archangel and the trumpet. I'm not sure if it's a golden, a silver trumpet or a ram's horn, but it's one of those. Now, the different kinds of blowing, some say you blow once, and that's for the whole congregation, well, twice the whole congregation blow both horns. Others say once for the leaders. The Jews say a long blast was to gather the people, and short staccato blast was alarm. I'm not sure if we know that for sure. But then here we have basically the getting ready, the preparation to leave Mount Sinai. We have been in Mount Sinai since Exodus 19. All of the rest of Exodus is at Mount Sinai. All the rest of Leviticus is at Mount Sinai. Numbers 1:1 through Numbers 10:10 is at Mount Sinai, and they're about to move. They're going to move up the wilderness of Paran along the eastern side of the Sinai Peninsula, and they're going to come to the oasis of Kadesh Barnea, where they're going to send the spies into the land, the tragedy of that account, the 40-year punishment of wandering in the wilderness, and then they're going to move again up over to the plains of Moab, right to the eastern side of the Jordan, just above the Dead Sea. And that's where we're going to move in this book. I want to say again, as I read these rules about this and that, and this person can't come, and that person can't come, and how you come, friends, I'm so glad I'm under the covenant of Jesus. He bids everybody come. Lepers, come. Eunuchs, come. Maimed people, come. Women, come with a bodily admission. Men, with a bodily admission. Sinners, even premeditated sinners, come. Boy, Jesus' blood is so much more effective than the blood of bulls and goats. Again, the best commentary on the Old Testament is the book of Hebrews, and I hope you'll look at that, because I'm so glad I don't have to offer sacrifices and do these little nitpicking rules and do this and this. Many folks say, well, if this is the scripture, if you don't do it, then you're violating God's law. Jesus himself, by his actions and his words, abrogated many of these cultural laws. But the principle behind it is always true. God is holy. He wants his people to be like him. Knowing God involves lifestyle, not just religious ritual. And all that we do in every area of our life ought to reflect who we are in our relationship to Jesus Christ. We remember that, and these laws will help us do that. Well, I've enjoyed being with you, and the only thing to cover real good is the cloud, but it led them in such a wonderful way. I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.